I suppose what I'm saying is, if you went back to the 50s and 60s, yes, people would come into the office and come behind the counter and chat with you and deliver tickets and this sort of thing. And progressively over the years, that happened less and less. You became more formal as an organisation. You had a proper counter, you had swing doors, and people weren't allowed beyond it, really, apart from the odd one or two that were going in and out every day. Or somebody would come to the counter, and then you'd say, "Come in," because you were sorting out a problem and this sort of thing. Yes. I mean, jobber's ledgers was an exception in the sense that whilst when you were doing jobber's ledgers, yes, you'd have a jobber's ledger clerk come around the firm and he'd sit down at a desk with your clerk and you'd actually tick out your accounts, one with the other. So yes, in that sense, but that was one part of the office.
And did you
all
have
of that's vanished, of course.
Did you have much contact with other jobbing firms? You've really referred to your involvement in various stock exchange committees, office managers committees.
Yes, we did, really. Stock Exchange Managers, Stock Exchange Managers Association. I can't remember when I actually joined that. It's after I became manager in 65. And it was an organisation that was quite useful because it did, prior to that organisation coming to being, which came into being in the early 60s, I think each individual firm, they had very little to do with one another. And then the Managers Association certainly drew people together socially, and then as we had the Stock Exchange became involved in settlement systems technically. So yes, you came to know what other managers of the major firms much more. So yes, I knew a lot of managers of various firms, and you would go to lunch and they'd come to lunch with you, this sort of thing. We had our luncheon rooms, one used those once a month, that sort of thing. And obviously when I was a partner then we had good lunch with somebody any time, one could book a room or into the main room if we wished. So yes, you did have quite a lot to do with other firms. The very fact you were competing with in the sense of dealing, and in some ways you were competing with in terms of your capability to settle. At the same time, it wasn't competitive in the sense you didn't talk to one another about your problems. And very often, of course, if we, I suppose Ackroyd and ourselves were the prime leaders in the context of stock exchange rules. And must remember, with things like takeovers and cash offers, this sort of thing, convertible stocks, a lot of rules, and coming of bargain accounting and talisman, a lot of rules had to be changed quite significantly. And in the earlier days, one would very much use one's influence and talk to other managers and talk to stock exchange officials to get rules changed. In latter days, and one was very much a part of the committee that changed the rules, and therefore it was easier than just trying to influence. So yes, you'd talk to other firms about problems you had, and problems with stamp duty, for instance, and the stamp office and their attitudes. And yes, I mean, yes, you would talk to other firms' managers, cooperate together and try to get change, which was very necessary.
When was it that you actually became a partner?
1974.
And what were the circumstances? As I said earlier, I saw that you'd become a member in 1968.
Yes.
why did the firm feel it was important that the office manager should be?
I think it was a trend, status essentially. I think it certainly wasn't in terms of the necessity relative to doing of one's job. Although I think in later years, it was important to have that status in the context of the stock exchange committees and their view of people. Still a place where status mattered to a reasonable degree in the context of influence. And I think more and more firms made their managers, the senior firms I'm talking about now, made their managers members. And then a few of the firms made their managers partners, but not many. Not many, certainly.
Did you feel this helped you generally in terms of running the firm?
Oh yes, very much so. Yes, you had more influence, definitely. More influence both internally and externally.
Just one of the ways of beginning to conclude, do you think you could describe it, what a typical working day would have been like for you sometime in the late 70s, or, you know, during the period after you'd become a partner? For example, what time would you find yourself leaving home?
Leaving home, or around about 20 to 8, close to 8, to be in. I'd never want to arrive sort of terribly, terribly early at my desk. I mean, not late, but I mean, not early. I'd be normally being by about 9, or be for 10 to 9, ideally, 9 o'clock, unless there was something particularly happening. I wanted to be in early for it, something pressing. Conversely, leaving to go home, 6, 7, 8. Depending again, 9 even, depending how busy we were really, even later. In fact, in the 72 boom, we were staying up in London on certain days, on the ticket passing days, keeping a lot of the staff in London in hotels, because we were working so late. Typical day, very hard to describe, frankly. I think the problem of a manager's day, as you've probably heard the saying, a manager knows less and less about more and more. An expert knows more and more about less and less. I mean, certainly it's true in a sense that one of the big problems for Wed, and I suppose part of my management task, not necessarily describing a day, was the management of the change that took place. I mean, for instance, we were initially an equity jobbing firm, then equity in gilts, then equity in Australian, and then we decided to trade in European stocks, and we went to gradually into different countries in Europe. Then we took over Medwin, and it was bearer stocks, Canada and America. And this is all the time, it's changing. These are all very different. They were different, and still are to a fair degree. Different settlement practices, different, you're dealing for a different period. You're, you have depositories, you have, you're using banks to settle your stock. You've got problems of securing your loans. You've got problems of risk in currency, as well as problem of reconciling your currency positions, your stock positions, problems of designing computer systems to actually encompass efficiently your settlement of foreign stocks and what we call, well, doesn't matter what we call them, bargains dealt in a currency which was different to the stock currency. For instance, as a jobbing firm. I mean, these are some of the decisions one had to make to rationalise the whole question. If you were dealing in another country's stocks, what currency did you deal in that stock? And if you dealt in that currency, you wanted to do a bargain in a different currency, then how did you cover that risk? How did you connect the two together? How did you manage your currency book? How did you get the information between these people? All of these sort of things came within my compass. So quite often, a lot of the day, parts of the day, will be looking after that sort of thing. Controlling change, really. Controlling, making decisions about things that people brought to you that they felt it was beyond their scope to make a decision. Or conversely, am I going to jail with something I felt was beyond my scope to make the decision? Fighting a court case in America, for instance, took up quite a lot of time. A lot of my time in latter years was very much the stock exchange. I mean, in the 70s, very much the stock exchange. I mean, I could be involved with the stock exchange probably 2 or 3 days a week. As I said, the Talisman, I chaired the Talisman Review Panel, and that didn't stop just chairing it. I mean, I was obviously involved in thinking about the papers before the meeting and thinking about the minutes and making sure they were correct, this sort of thing. I mean, it's very technical stuff. Rules, the Rules Committee I was on. I was on the CGO, the committee I developed the initial ideas for the original CGO, not the CGO system it is today, which is computerised, but prior to that, we evolved a stock exchange system for gilt settlement, which changed it from chaos to a reasonably good system, and then we moved to CGO after that. I was heavily involved in that, and Gerald and I spent quite a lot of time on this on a gilt, stock exchange gilt committee to bring about the changes in gilt settlement. So I suppose it's probably true to say 50% of one's time in that years was really managing change, both in the context of the firm and in the context of the stock exchange. And the rest of the time was, I suppose, and it's very hard to say 50-50, I mean, it's not really very from day to day, just managing the firm day to day. When you're talking about, whether you're talking about salaries, or whether you're talking about people leaving or employing people. Although, to be fair, I mean, as the firm grew, we ended up with an administration department. Graham then came back from the house and became responsible for managing the salary committee and the salaries, and it shifted weights off of one, and one needed those weights to be shifted. And one was very grateful for and the whole of the balancing of the firm's books and all the administrative side of that, VAT, everything else, all secretarial work, all that sort of thing, all moved away. I mean, and it moved away whilst I was manager, essentially, to a really large degree. So it left one more free to manage the business, if you like, and manage the running of settlement, organisation of people. I mean, one of the in the earlier days, one of the core things each day was to manage the resources in the sense of having the people where we needed them on a day-to-day basis. The cycle shifted the workload. I mean, in the days of ticket pass, you had a very distinctive workload that shifted round the various departments. In the sense that, as I said, you had checking and managing resources for checking, the number of people you needed that on a day-to-day basis. Then on ticket week, you needed to manage the resources to pass tickets. The following week, you had to manage have the resources available to handle the stock, to move the stock fast enough, because the stock obviously mattered in the context of interest costs and getting your stock to the bank in terms of collateral against your loans. So you had to have the resources for that. So in a sense, certainly the days before Talisman, you were managing your resource, and to a degree before bargain accounting, your resources on literally a day-to-day basis. Because inevitably people who are in a department are reluctant to move and help another department. And you have to actually, although every week and every day it tended to happen, you actually had to manage it and make sure it happened. So part of your day was always assessing your workloads and where they were. Oh, it became fairly second nature, but it still had to be done. I mean, I always believed in managing actively in the sense of, you know, walking around the firm as well. I always had my office at the end of the major office. I had to walk through it. I deliberately used to do that on the basis that if you had it at the beginning of an office, then when you walked through that office, it was unusual. Where if you had your office at the very end of the office, a lot. I mean, we had open plan offices, which again, I believed in personally. I believe they're right. So I had it at the end, and I would walk right through the office to my desk and right out again. So quite frequently, and every time I walked through, I'd be looking around to see what was happening, because one, as manager, knowing the business, you could actually sense it, and you'd look at it and see what was happening. Whether people needed help or not, this sort of thing.
When did you actually decide to retire?
Just put it another way, decide not to continue.
Yes. You better elaborate on that.
Well, let me put it this way. In the run-up to Big Bang, I was asked if I would stay on for 2 years beyond my retirement date. I mean, the firm, you appreciate the firm, where had retired their partners at 60, on their 60th birthday, or the Friday after, I can't remember now, the Friday after, I think it was actually, we wed, where the bank retired them on the 60th birthday, or the day before the 60th birthday. And I was asked if I would be prepared to stay on prior to Big Bang, when all the negotiations were going on. And I thought about it very deeply, and initially I said no, I was not, but I was prepared to be a consultant. And eventually, I decided that that wasn't really a runner either. I mean, by then we'd seen enough of the bank and the bank, sorry, the bank, I mean, what was become BZW and the senior management. And their approach to life, in my view, is rather different to mine. And I frankly did believe that my style of management and way of doing things was different to the style of management and way of doing things of the bank. And I was running up to 60, and I decided that it would be far better if I did retire at 60 rather than stay on, and actually retire rather than not even become a consultant, because they had enough competence there. And I also believe, frankly, that if you are in a senior sort of management role, whoever follows after you wants to manage it their way and do it their way. And it is far better to actually.
How had you felt when the stock exchange decided to do away with single capacity?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I hadn't thought about that.
Or what was the feeling in the firm?
I think there was a feeling of inevitability about the problems of the stock exchange, the problems of the jobbing system, coming back to what I was saying earlier about the problems of the markets moving more and more one way, and jobbers collectively becoming less and less profitable because of the size of risk involved and the money you did or did not make on your dealing positions. So I think there was a feeling that change had to come. And you have to remember that, of course, we were in a situation where the Monopolies Commission was looking at the stock exchange in the context of commissions, etc. And, of course, in theory, if you go back to before Big Bang, when the decisions were made, they weren't made on the basis of doing away with single capacity. I think you'll find the actual original papers issued by the government actually didn't talk about that at all. They actually expected it to continue. It was the market itself that believed it could not continue. And what you believe in tends to become true, whether that's whether it's inevitable or not. I mean, it's almost self-fulfilling. I think as a firm, we were worried that given that single capacity would go, that the firm would get pulled apart by demand from other firms for dealing experience, because if you actually looked at the total dealing experience or jobbing experience on the exchange, it couldn't add up to many hundreds of people compared with the very large numbers of broking firms and brokers. And if a large number of those broking firms wanted to actually set up dealing capability, then they would look to the jobbers to pull staff from those jobbers. And of course, that's what happened to a fair degree.
Yes.
We had a very difficult time in the run-up to Big Bang with firms wanting to set up dealing teams. And of course, if you want the kingpin in the sense of your team, then you can afford to pay virtually anything to get that one person to, as a nucleus to your new dealing organisation. That was what was tending to happen to us as a firm. We were tending to lose people, no matter what. In my view, no matter what we did in terms of increasing salaries, which is actually what we did, you couldn't hold people because somebody would always overbid, no matter what you did. And that was the tendency. And that was the reason primarily why we made a large number of people partners in the run-up to Big Bang, to actually hold them. I haven't really answered your question, which was what was my attitude to the change. I think my attitude was inevitable. It was an inevitable situation that jobbing was dying on its feet, essentially. I couldn't see any solution conceptually to the way in which the markets were becoming one-way markets and the size of the risks involved. It wasn't a change of dealing system. It wasn't necessarily just capital, although most people thought it was. It wasn't. I mean, you can afford to run a position, but if you then lose, you take that position, you lose significant amounts of money. Okay, that's capital, but it's still profit and loss in the end. You can't carry on doing that for too long, otherwise you have no capital left. And anyway, people are very risk averse in many ways, in the sense of running. Some people delight in large positions and running those positions, and some don't. But as a firm on the whole, you tend to be aware of the risk positions you are comfortable with and that above which you become uncomfortable in terms of the risk of not being able to get rid of those positions.
Let me just switch the focus again to some of the firm's senior partners and whether how you describe them or what your salient memories of them are. You mentioned earlier Esmond de Lacker in the early days being someone who was ambitious for the firm.
I'd describe him as a person that he knew jobbing, he knew a lot of people in the city and outside the city. He was an intelligent man, he knew where he wanted to go. And he was a very nice man to talk to as well.
What about Sir Nigel Mordaunt, who's
a very good jobber? A very charming man. Successful senior partner in the sense of managing, holding the firm together, managing the change that took place in terms of Wed and Durlacher. I don't think he could have done what Esmond Duerker did. I don't think he had that sort of approach to life, that sort of mind.
In what sense? In the sense that Esmond Duerker had a vision about where he wanted the firm to go?
Whether it was a vision or whether it was more a case of opportunism, in the sense that he realised that you could no longer job in one market because that market could be dead and therefore you're dead as a firm for a year until the market starts again. You had to go into more markets and therefore you had to, the easiest way to do it was buy out jobbing firms. And anyway, they were being unsuccessful commercially and therefore it was easy to buy them up really cheaply. So I would never know whether it was vision or opportunism. I suspect it was both, in actual fact, in terms of Esmond.
Was it his nature,
Esmond,
to be like that?
I wasn't close enough to really comment, I don't think.
Right? Yes.
I suppose the answer probably is yes, in the sense that, you know, he met Anthony Salmon. As far as I know, he met Anthony Salmon at a cocktail party and talked about computers and decided, yes, we ought to look at it. So probably yes.
And what about Dick Wilkins? How would you contrast him with someone like Esmond Duerker or Nigel Morland?
This is jolly difficult to answer. Strong, a very strong-willed man who wanted to do what he wanted to do, I think. Very much the boss, very respected by everybody. And I describe him as very much a man's man. Sort of great fun. He always talked to everybody. He never sort of talked down to people. Very popular with everybody. I liked him immensely. But not a thoughtful man, because he wasn't that sort of man at all. Given to spontaneous decisions, really, I think. Probably not given to listening to advice too much either. And yet, I think he made a success of being a senior partner. I mean, they've all made a success of being a senior partner in their own way. Yes, I think they did in their own ways, and they were probably men of that particular period. I mean, Dick Wilkins was senior partner in a period when the gilt market was very difficult, and that was the area he knew best anyway, so he managed, on the whole, seemed to manage that very well, manage the dealing partners in that area very well, which was more difficult when he retired, no doubt about that. I suppose there wasn't a lot of fundamental change when Dick was in charge, really. And again, there wasn't any real, in a sense, need for it. I think I've said enough about him.
Yes. Yes.
He's a very nice man, actually.
Yes.
Very nice indeed.
Would you say a jobbing firm had provided you with a very different career to that you might have had with a broking firm or other city firms? Was there anything distinctive about working for a jobbing firm, even in terms of management?
I can sort of see two or three things in the context of my career path. I mean, first and foremost, changing from broker to jobbing. It was a decision made really more on the basis of I'd gone as far as I could in that firm. I couldn't go become a dealer because I could no longer walk properly in the context of Fenner Crossway. I couldn't see them paying me any more money. I mean, these are sort of collection of reasons why I went into jobbing. Context of jobbing, I think, again, the very fact that I couldn't stand on my feet all day meant I couldn't go down to the stock exchange where everybody else, all the people that joined the firm, the sort of period I did of my sort of age and younger, went to the stock exchange as dealers. I can well remember the manager of the firm, Appleby, at one time saying, well, if you can't go down the house, you'll be manager one day. I think in some ways, without boasting, they were lucky that I never went down the house because I again, although I didn't do well at school, I had the logical and intellectual capability to actually realise and understand systems of bookkeeping and how to computerise them and use computers to the advantage of the firm. Again, I would maintain, as I said earlier, the growth of the firm was directly related to and connected to the growth of the ability of the firms to actually manage themselves and keep in control, especially in the more stringent environments we have gradually moved in terms of control of risk and this sort of thing, reporting to the stock exchange. I mean, the question of reporting to the stock exchange, your firm's accounts and this sort of thing, it's all became much more stringent over the years because, again, the problems of risk in terms of firms going bust and being hammered, when the stock exchange got much more tough over the years. Yes, I'm quite sure if I'd stayed in broking and stayed with that firm, I might have got to be manager. And the manager of that firm is that's a medium-sized firm, reasonably big now, I suppose. That's all I would have ever been. So in the context of jobbing, yes, the fact that I went into jobbing when it was starting to grow, and I grew with it, no doubt about that, met the challenge, and yes, I became a relatively wealthy man because I was successful in a very successful firm. So yes, it certainly changed. I'm quite sure that change in jobbing was something that helped me immensely in terms of life.
Good.
And very stressful experience, but at the same time, a very enjoyable experience. And marvellous people to work with, actually. I might cuss them on occasions, but great. I mean, Wed De Laca was a marvellous firm, and PZW will never be anything like it, I don't think, because it was very, its roots were a family firm. And the thinking, despite the fact we got up to 500 people, was still basically the same. They were interested in their staff, they looked after them. And it wasn't a welfare state, but in a way it was a firm that were interested in people. They weren't just employees. Enjoyed it immensely.
Good. I think we'll finish on that note. Thank you very much.